KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next forum hour, major changes are on the way in what promises to be a real shakeup of the present state system of criminal justice. We'll find out what the proposal plans are, the legislation that's been passed, and the details of it, and how likely are real benefits to happen as we focus our attention on the changing nature of juvenile justice here in California. Forum is next with a panel and your calls right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Following Governor Schwarzenegger's convening of a juvenile justice working group, State Senator Anthony Machado helped engineer a bill which attempts to tackle head-on many of the myriad problems that have been plaguing the state's juvenile justice system by moving things more to the counties. Under the bill, all but the most violent youths would be essentially dealt with in their home counties, and the hope is that this will cut the number of young people who are in juvenile prisons, which are operated by the Department of Juvenile Justice. It has gone up exponentially. In fact, right now, California holds about three times the national average. In this hour, we want to focus on changes and reform in the juvenile justice system, what Senate Bill 81, sponsored by Senator Machado, will mean for California. We have a panel assembled with us, and first we want to go to State Senator Michael Machado, who, by the way, is state senator from the 5th State District and not only a sponsor of Senate Bill 81, but also really the man who has pushed it forward, and a lot of credit is due. And thank you for joining us, Senator.
It's a pleasure to be here, Michael.
We got to mention that the district that the senator is from includes parts of San Joaquin, Yolo, and Sacramento, and he is joining us this morning from Sacramento. Let's just get a picture of what this is promising to really cut in half the number of youth offenders, at least who are in prison or incarcerated.
Yes, it's probably to reduce it down to about a third from where we're at now. And the level we're at now is a reduction from about 10,000 of several years ago. We have about 2,700 wards in our facilities. But the importance is not so much to reduce it. It is to establish a common base of treatment, whether it be at the state or at the counties, to provide behavioral treatment programs for youthful offenders that we can put them back in society to be productive citizens.
There's a good deal of hope attached to this, especially as far as recidivism then, yeah?
Very, very much so, because right now our state facilities are often the training ground or the high school for matriculation into our state prisons, and that's inexcusable. And the state is under court order because of the lack of programming, the lack of sufficient health care, and the lack of sufficient facilities. Unfortunately, many of our counties are equally challenged. They are not equipped for long-term commitments. They're not equipped with behavioral programs, and they don't necessarily have the facilities. So what this legislation does is says, okay, we need to have a continuum of care that looks at how we would treat youthful offenders from the least low-risk, nonviolent, to the high-risk, violent, and that we also need to make sure that we have horizontal and vertical consistency, so counties between counties, state between counties, in terms of the programming based on assessment and common databases. This bill would allow the establishment of that through a juvenile justice commission that includes county representatives along with the state to do that. And what it also does is provide for non-707Bs, nonviolence now, to be held at the county level. And I think this is the first step into reforming California's treatment of youthful offenders from the local to the state level, similar to what other states have done before us, in particular Washington State.
Well, also Missouri is an example of this, isn't it?
Yes.
We're talking, by the way, with State Senator Michael Machado from the 5th State District, sponsor of Senate Bill 81, which is the Juvenile Justice Bill of 2007. I guess the real question comes down to resources, and I noticed that the governor, in fact, John Myers, called to my attention, vetoed about $15 million in funding for county implementation of new juvenile justice programs with his line item veto. This must come as a bit of a whack.
Well, it does, and there's a lot to question what the reasoning was in the governor's vetoing of many items. And I think this leads to the problems that we have not only in our juvenile system at the state, but also the adult prison system. It takes resources up front to try to address the problem, and those resources provide, if put up front, provide tremendous return later on with reduction of recidivism and the ability to provide the type of programs that allow young people to turn their lives around. And for the I'm perplexed at why the governor would try to cut that and still maintain a yacht credit for wealthy yacht owners.
We're going to have the resources that the counties need?
The counties will have the per diem resources that would ordinarily be paid for a youth that's in state facilities now at the county levels. What has to go along with this is going to be the ability for the counties to have the resources to adjust their facilities to be able to go from short-term detentions to long-term commitments.
State Senator Michael Machado, again, State Senator from the 5th District and sponsor of Senate Bill 81. I thank you so much for joining us, Senator, and good luck with bringing not only this bill as you have to fruition, but seeing that it's implemented in ways that will really bring about the kind of needed reform and major reforms that you've been talking about.
Oh, thank you, and we look forward to being able to work with all parties for the successful implementation of this.
And again, that's State Senator Michael Machado. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. Daniel McClaire is with us here in studio, and he's Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Welcome, Dan McClaire.
Morning, Michael.
Morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Karen Pank, who's Executive Director, Chief Probation Officers of California, joins us from Sacramento. Welcome, Karen Pank.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Perry Gabrielle Jones, Youth Advocate for DDAT, Detention Diversion Advocacy Program. And he chairs the San Francisco Mayor's Youth Task Force Committee, former inmate of the CYA. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you as well.
And he's joining us from Oakland this morning. Daniel McClaire, let's begin with just the sense of what this will really do as we see it. I mean, we've talked about juvenile justice with you on a number of occasions. This is the most major reform package that we've seen, this legislation, in quite some time. I know you're very pleased, but you have some skepticism.
Well, Michael, actually, we should point out this is probably the biggest juvenile justice reform of the last 100 years in the state of California. It's a complete restructuring of the old system. And I think we should congratulate Senator Machado for his extraordinary efforts in pushing this legislation through, because it wasn't easy. But it does address a number of problems that he highlighted, and I think that need to be explained. First of all, there is a huge disparity in California, county by county, on the types of kids that historically get committed to the youth authority. San Francisco, which has a rich array of resources at the county level, sends very few kids to the California Youth Authority historically. And the same is true, ironically, with Orange County, which is a conservative county. San Francisco, reputation as a liberal county. San Diego County sends very few kids to the California Youth Authority historically. But then you've got other counties like Monterey County and Riverside County and San Bernardino County then send an extraordinary number of kids to the youth authority. And there's no rhyme or reason. It very often rests with the political culture in the individual counties. Everybody knows that conditions in the youth authority were abominable. It's been known for 20 years. I've been involved in this, as you know, for that.
Even words like squalid keep coming up. No, seriously.
Yeah. No, the conditions were absolutely abominable. I mean, there was an expert panel of five outside experts were called in last year in March 2006 to complete a report and make recommendations to the state about how they could fix the system. These five outside these were correctional people. They came out, they issued a report, and basically they said is that the system was beyond fixing, that it was broken in virtually every way. There was a culture of violence that permeated all the institutions. Kids, when they entered the institutions, divided racially, ethnically, and geographically. So you had this state of constant warfare between wards who were living in these antiquated dormitories where up to 75 kids could be held at any particular time. And sometimes during certain shifts, you'd have one staff person on duty who sat in a cage and never came out. And if a fight broke out, his only responsibility was to throw in a tear gas bomb into the dormitory and then summon a roving SWAT team. Conditions were absolutely horrendous. You had situations where you had kids who were severely mentally ill. The system had no capacity to address their situation, and so what they would often end up doing is placing these kids for long periods of time. Kids who were severely mentally ill, in some cases psychotic, placing them in these disciplinary units, which were single-celled units, where if anyone had ever been inside of them, if we treated animals at the zoo this way, the Humane Society would have had it shut down. You'd walk into these cells, you'd have the stench of urine, you'd have feces on the wall, garbage on the floor, and these were units that were either used for kids who were disciplinary problems, who were heavy gangbangers in the units who were exploiting other kids, or you had these same units being used for the mentally ill. Just horrendous conditions.
Well, you painted quite a picture here, and one of violence and overcrowding, but also inadequate services. I mean, education,
resources,
health, mental health care, and so forth.
The Youth Authority had always been starved of resources, in fairness. It's always been starved of resources. It was never able to provide adequate educational services, adequate mental health services. And yes, this was one of its basic mandates. At the very least, you would think that the state would have funded the system enough to provide adequate educational services. But on any given day, up to 30% of the kids in the Youth Authority who were supposed to be taking classes weren't there because either there was no teacher available, the pay was so bad that they couldn't retain teachers, they couldn't recruit and they couldn't retain, and if they were lucky enough to find a teacher, if that teacher went on vacation or that teacher was sick that particular day, classes were canceled. Or you also have the classic conflict that occurs in a correctional institution where, you know, the conflict between the education and treatment staff and the custodial staff. The custodial staff, those are the people who primarily responsible for watching over the living units. If they decided on a particular day that a kid wasn't going to go to school, or a kid told the custodial staff that he didn't want to attend classes, the kid wouldn't attend classes, and there was nothing there to compel them to do that.
Talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Daniel McAleer, who is executive director and co-founder of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. And Senate Bill 81 going to change all this, or is it mainly cosmetic? Or, I mean, where are the resources going to be? Again, we get to that, don't we?
Well, the old system was a system designed to fail. It was an old 19th century training school model. It didn't work in the 19th century, and it certainly didn't work in the 21st century. So I think SB 81, if nothing else, hopefully brings an end to this old training school system. The challenge, obviously, now is how well the counties will adapt their services to meet the challenges of this new population. Now, some counties will do well. Some counties already have the resources in place or the array of programs that can be, you know, that can be tweaked and adjusted, and their service levels raised to meet the challenge. Other counties will have a more difficult time, particularly the smaller counties, the counties that don't have that don't necessarily have all the resources, don't necessarily have all the wealth of some of the larger urban counties. But this becomes now the role of the state to ensure that there is some degree of uniformity, that the counties won't have a youth authority to fall back on to commit kids simply because they choose, or they don't have the resources, or they choose not to provide sufficient resources. So the counties are going to have to rise up to the challenge. And this will be what will remain to be seen. This is one of the things that we will have to be monitoring over the next few years.
You're being cautiously hopeful, I think.
Michael, I think there are two goals here. The old California Youth Authority was a relic of the past. It had to go. And if nothing else, I hope AB 81 achieves that.
SB 81.
SB 81, I'm sorry.
Well, let's bring in Karen Panka again, who's Executive Director of the Chief Probation Officers of California. I want to find out, Karen Panka, how you view 81. One of the ways, I suppose, of getting your response is sort of bringing up a metaphor that you use. You said that changing the system is like trying to change tires on a bus while it's moving.
That's very true, Michael. I think we have been describing our view of SB 81 as cautiously optimistic. I couldn't agree more with what your previous guests have stated. I mean, first, I want to thank Senator Machado for really being an advocate for the entire reform this year, as well as working with us to try to address some of the issues that were just pointed out by Daniel. I mean, this isn't something that we can snap our fingers and think that change is going to happen overnight. And it is one of the biggest reforms that we've seen in the juvenile justice system, you know, potentially ever. And so there's a lot of hope wrapped up in that from our perspective as well, because we are charged with making sure that the juveniles are treated well within our system, that they are rehabilitated and reintegrated back into society while at the same time protecting community safety. So, you know, it's a delicate balance. And when you add a new population to the current populations that we are in charge of working with, you definitely need to look at how are you going to do that. And different counties will have face different challenges. So definitely agree with some of the things I've just been said. However, I would say we're optimistic because we have been successful in the past with some of our changes in the juvenile system. It was mentioned before, I think, by Senator Machado that we were at about 10,000 kids in CYA for not so long ago, and that number has been slowly declining to about 3,000. I think now we're maybe close to 2,800, maybe even lower than that. And we believe that
that's in a decade, pretty much. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we believe, though, as far as the chief probation officers, that we had something to do with that decline, that we were committed to keeping some more kids local for obvious reasons. We felt we could do a better job with them. We felt that keeping them in the community keeps those family ties together, also helps us reintegrate them back into the community when their time is done with us. But in addition, and I think this is the most important piece, and it's kind of been woven in with all of the previous descriptions, resources. The state started to commit years ago to a program called JJCPA, the Juvenile Justice Crime Prevention Act, which sends right now in this budget year $119 million to counties to reinvest in their juvenile justice system in a way to prevent further crime. And what we've done in the probation world is really utilize that to beef up some of the services that we can offer locally so we didn't have to use the state facilities. And so what we are hopeful is that the state doesn't kind of, you know, wipe their hands clean now that SB 81 has passed and say, okay, our part of the reform is done, because the hardest part of the reform is yet to come, and that's the implementation and ensuring that those resources are there and put into the right places so that we can have some of that uniformity that was just discussed.
You're certainly going to need state support on that score. We're talking, by the way, with Karen Pank, Executive Director of the Chief Probation Officers of California. Does this mean a kind of sea change as you see it between from punishment more toward rehabilitation?
Well, you know, the juvenile system has always been intended to be about rehabilitation, and that's one of our main charges.
So, clearly it hasn't been succeeding, though, has it?
Well, you know, I definitely, the descriptions of what was going on at CYA and just kind of some of the problems there certainly lend itself to a non-rehabilitative atmosphere. And I think that's one of the reasons why we at the county level have really been struggling to find ways to try to keep more of that population locally, so that we could hopefully do more with them. But, you know, we have to recognize, too, that, you know, many counties ended up having to send juveniles to CYA because they didn't have the resources to deal with some very severe problems that some of the juveniles had, such as severe mental health issues, severe health issues, period, and certainly some behavioral problems. And so one of the things that Senator Machado pointed out at the beginning of the show is that, you know, there are going to be struggles with various counties to make sure that they are in a position to change those wheels on the bus as it's going forward, meaning, you know, they are starting September 1 next week. This bill goes into effect, and we will have a new group of kids under our charge locally, but yet there hasn't been the investment of resources to build out some of those programs locally to make sure we can deal with them. So that's where that analogy comes into play, and I think that's where our caution and our concern comes as it relates to the reform.
Understood. And again, that's Karen Pank from the Probation Officers of California. We also have Perry Gabrielle Jones with us this morning from Oakland, Youth Advocate for DDAT, Detention Diversion Advocacy Program. He chairs San Francisco Mayor Newsom's Youth Task Force Committee and is a former CYA inmate, alumnus of CYA, we might say. Not a very good experience, was it?
I mean, it was a good experience, but it was also a bad experience. I think it was a good experience for me because, I mean, it was just a blessing and it was an exception made for me that I had the willpower and I had community support throughout me. I was in there for a decade, and it took a lot of people that, you know, that came in contact with me when I was younger and that stuck with me mainly from the community that kept me socializing and kept me with a vision. So, yeah, it was a bad experience, but it also was a good experience, you know, thanks to me having self-determination and a lot of support.
Yeah, but you sounds like you rehabilitated yourself. It wasn't necessarily the institution that helped you.
Exactly. Yeah, my situation, like the whole over thing, first of all, before I go any further, I would like to thank the whole panel and the senator, man, for this progress and this reform. This is actually a dream come true for me. This has actually been a goal. So I would like to thank y'all for the efforts y'all been putting towards this. But as far as my personal experience in there, I think that it really did, if I was an exception and if I didn't have the willpower that I had, I think it really could have broke me, and that would lead me to doing the work that I do today. I mean, sitting in CYA, and I've seen various aspects of the system, from the mental health, from the health, from the education, to the isolation programs, you feel me? I think that it was all messed up, but I think that right now is a big opportunity right now for the form to rehappen, because it's definitely needed within that system, and I'm basically coming here myself and saying that it's needed.
Well, what do you tell the young people who are going into the system, whom you counsel, about the system to advise them really to deal with it?
I think the best advice that I would give to a person that's going into the system is to be able to look beyond the system, to try to focus on the transition when they're coming home. I mean, because going inside of there is just pretty much is a phase that you're going to be going through, and if there are, I can't really speak because my experience with the system been actually kind of hard. So I don't know what type of, you know, services is being provided in CYA or other parts of the system. But the advice that I would tell them is to be able to try to find that person that they feel that their intuition is letting them know have a best interest towards their overall transition and just the healing process. Because in there, coming across a person who's really genuine is really hard. I mean, when you're in the system and you got staff dealing with their own situations and dealing with administration and different type of politics, a lot of the time they forget about their whole purpose of starting to work in a correctional facility. So just find, you know, if a kid can actually find a person that can help them out and take education serious while they're in there, that's a big priority.
Perry, can you stay with us past the break a little bit?
Yeah.
Good. We'll continue our discussion here. In fact, we invite you, our listeners, to join us with any questions or comments. We're talking about Senate Bill 81, passed by State Senator Michael Machado, whom we spoke to earlier, which promises some major reforms in the juvenile justice system. You can join us toll-free if you have questions or comments. It's 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number and lines are available to you. It's 866-733-6786, or send an email, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing the Juvenile Justice Reform Plan recently approved by the California State Legislature, and we talked earlier with State Senator Michael Machado about it, who sponsored the bill, Senate Bill 81. You are welcome to join us, and in fact, if you have some reactions to this legislation or if you have some questions about it, we welcome your phone call. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That will work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. And again, We would like to hear from you. It's 866-733-6786 or by email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. And with us by phone, Perry Gabrielle Jones, a youth advocate for DDET, Detention Division Advocacy Program, who chairs the San Francisco Mayor's Youth Task Force Committee, former inmate from the California Youth Authority. Karen Pank, also with us, is Executive Director of the Chief Probation Officers of California. And Daniel McAllair is Executive Director and co-founder of the Center on Juvenile Criminal Justice. And we were just talking off air, Daniel and I, were about how this has been a long time coming. And if you think that reform has been difficult historically from the perspective of seeing it brought to the stage with respect to youth incarceration, you can imagine what it's going to be for adult incarceration. But the youth numbers are down, we need to point out, which is all part of the equation as far as youth crime and youth felony. Daniel?
It's really, we're going through an extraordinary time. Since 1992, juvenile delinquency in the state of California peaked in 1992. Since 1992, we've seen an unprecedented decline in youth crime across the state, fallen to levels that we have not seen since the mid-1960s. Essentially, kids are better behaved today, and this is, unfortunately, this does not get a lot of publicity. Kids are better behaved today than they have been at any time in the last 40 years.
It's also less drug use. There appears to be, at least in some instances, not with methamphetamine, but
sure,
you know, some of the harder drugs.
There's a lot of, I'm sure, and there's a lot of reasons for it. But what's interesting is that as youth crime was declining, the rate of youth incarceration in California was also declining to unprecedented levels. In 1959, we had 4,200 kids in the California Youth Authority. We now have 2,600. It's one of the lowest commitment rates in the nation right now. And which kind of defies conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom on which we've based our adult prison policies is that the more people you have incarcerated, that's what brings the crime rate down. Exactly the opposite has happened at the juvenile level. And I think that, you know, I think it's an extraordinary time. And I think that I think we're going to see, hopefully we're going to see some changes where we can, California can become a model for juvenile justice. We have an unprecedented opportunity.
Well, we have an opportunity to bring our callers in too, and let's do that. Patricia, we'll start with you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I'm very glad you have this subject on. I'm a teacher in one of the juvenile halls locally here in the Bay Area, and I've noticed that there is a dissension between the staff that is caring for the students representing probation and sometimes the teachers. And I think that's a really important thing that would be addressed by this bill or the people who are enacting its implementation. The kids often love the staff. The kids often love us. But then you feel a little like, where would my loyalty be in some of the children who perhaps are, not that they put the teachers down, but that they are the boss. They are the parents in residence, the staff, and then the teachers, well, we're just the educators. Am I making myself clear at all?
Yeah, I believe you are. And Karen Pank, let's get a comment from you.
Well, I think what we've seen is we're most successful when we use a collaborative approach, and it's never just one piece that really can turn a kid's life around. Education is a key component to that. Certainly, you know, building and fostering the relationships between the counselors, the correctional counselors in a juvenile hall with those kids who have to be there with them 24/7 is very, very critical. And we've seen when those relationships are good relationships is when we see positive outcomes. And then, of course, you have to bring in all sorts of other treatment modalities for these kids, you know, as I mentioned before, the mental health and others. So it's certainly, you know, maybe at times can seem like, you know, we take the position of being maybe the team leader on that kind of a scenario. And it's because we feel that, and we know that the kids are within our charge and have to try to do all of the things that we can to get them the services needed while at the same time just providing for their care 24/7. So I do think that we've seen time and time again when that collaboration is strong, when that teamwork is strong, it benefits the kid.
Let me thank the caller, Daniel McIntyre.
Yeah, what the caller expresses is a common problem in correctional institutions, because you do have kind of a natural conflict that occurs between the treatment staff and the custodial staff. The custodial staff being the people who have 24-hour supervision, responsibility for 24-hour supervision of the kids. And sometimes the educational staff, the priorities often differ. The key is the leadership within the system, and making it known to everyone that treatment services and educational service are indeed a priority, that we are here to rehabilitate. We are not just here to be prison guards. And this really has to be, this has to come from the top, and it has to be communicated to all the different staff in all the different departments.
Talking about attitude here and also the potential for mentoring and all of that, and Perry Gabrielle Jones, how important from your perspective is that team effort, and a team effort which really is bent more on rehabilitation and on helping and supporting?
I think, like as she said, though, that was one big issue that I had that I was dealing with a lot, which kind of made me detach myself from authority figures. I think that kind of put a kid into being confused exactly what authority figure to be able to respect. And for me, in the education, that's been a big thing for me, and that's what really helped me transition a lot. I mean, you may be having teachers in there who knows how to deal with a kid on an individual basis, but it'd be the conflict of interest when it comes to dealing with mental health staff or when it comes to dealing with staff on the line who may not like that kid for a particular reason. So I think that it needs to be prioritized as far as everything, whether it's education, whether it's the council, the counselor, whoever. And I think those adult figures need to be able to work closely with each other to come with an individualized plan for each individual kid that's there. Because actually the conflict of interest between teachers and staff, I mean, that right there is pretty much can back a kid into a corner. And I think that that right there is kind of a bad example for the kids. I think that they should all work together some type of way towards the best interest of the kids.
So you're saying that really programs should be as individually tailored or suited to the individual as possible?
Yeah, that's like, with me on a personal note, I mean, speaking when I was in CYA, I may be having a situation with a particular staff member who probably had a discrepancy with me on a personal note or whatever the problem was, and when I go to school, when they drop us off in the classroom, he may give the teacher a report that was from way from the unit. You feel me? We pretty much can have an interfere with the whole relationship between me and my teacher, or it can be the total opposite. So I think that for the most part, though, it should be an individualized plan for each kid. Each kid, it should be an individualized plan for that kid and also between the staff who's dealing with him so they can all be on the same page.
Perry Gabrielle Jones, I know that you feel pretty strongly that you were a casualty of the justice system, even though it did good things for you ultimately, but mislabeled you, mishandled you, didn't prepare you enough to go back to the community, that a lot of what you've been able to achieve and accomplish, for which you certainly deserve great commendation, mm-hmm. had to do with your own will and your own self-motivation. Now, here's a question from a listener named Jay who says, what did juveniles say when asked, and I'm asking it directly of you, Perry, what would have helped you avoid the whole thing at an earlier age? I'm talking about the juveniles that you counsel.
I think what would have helped me from even going to CYA, which I try my best, even with the work that I'm doing right now, to even try to prevent kids from even having to go the route that I went. With the whole situation with me, man, I didn't have that many outlets that as these kids have nowadays, with so many resources within the community, which gives the kid to empower yourself, for them to be able to have the opportunity to do things and then have someone who they can talk to, just like with DDAP alone, with the model that's set up through DDAP and me working there, I'm very content with it because it also is able to identify a kid that may be going through a problem at the home or maybe going through a problem just transitioning in school or even just transitioning in a negative environment. Just having that one person that you can kind of like tap into consistently, not just one day, not just 2 days, that can be there through you and help you navigate through the transition of adolescence. I think that would have helped me out a lot. Another thing that would have helped me out a lot to prevent that is the educational system. I mean, me going to school when I was younger, I mean, I was born in a complex, housing complex area where a lot of things around me that was negative. And a lot of those things I would take to school. And I probably wouldn't talk and I probably wouldn't say nothing because I was disturbed about some of the things that I may have experienced. And I don't think that those things, it should have been a red flag that should have came up from the educational system. And they didn't catch that. And because of that, I pretty much, you know, confined within myself. And being young, I made a lot of mistakes, which, you know, resulted to where I went. So I think that the educational system, whether it's the mental health system on the streets, y'all need to be able to recognize red flags and deal with them.
Perry Gabriel Jones, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your being with us this morning. Perry Gabriel Jones, again, is a youth advocate for DDAT, Detention Diversion Advocacy Program, and he chairs San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom's Youth Task Force Committee and is a former California Youth Authority inmate. Let me go to more of your calls, and we go next to Oakland. Lou, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Even with the best intentions, what the gentleman was just speaking about consistency, issues like this come up, and there's studies, and there's new plans and things of this nature, but the follow-through is just so important. That, you know, these aren't things to start talking about, you know, like once every couple of years. There's scandals every once, you know, every couple of years, and then the issue gets brought up. But these kids are in a position, they don't vote, they're behind bars. Whatever happens to them is pretty much done, you know, in secret as far as the rest of the, as the rest of the society is concerned, because people are too busy or just don't know. And, I'm ranting a little bit. My main question was, what about the issue? It sounds wonderful to devolve the responsibility to a more localized level and be able to give the kids more more specific help in closer to where they come from. But local communities have financial pressures added to them all the time. And what's going to happen when the state puts the responsibility on the localities to take care of these kids, and then there isn't the financial capability to really be able to do it properly? No matter the same chores are still going to have to be done, no matter who's in charge or who's doing it.
Lou, you're raising the big question, isn't he, Daniel McAleer?
Very important point. Under SB 81. The state has promised to provide the counties with a subsidy of $117,000 per kid. Now, that amount could buy you a lot of services at the local level. The counties are nervous because the counties were nervous when all this started, because historically there's always been that failing of the state to follow through on its promises, and the counties end up getting caught with the bill. And so one of the tests is going to be, does the state follow through, and does that subsidy continue on in subsequent years? That's going to be the test. But in order to make this work, the resources that we currently invest in these old California youth authority institutions needs to be taken and reinvested back into the counties, transferred back to the counties, so the counties can do the job and do the job right. That will be the test of the success of SB 81.
And let me thank Lou for the call and move to more of your calls. We go next to Kathleen. Karen Prank, yes.
Yeah, can I just add to that? Because I think it's a really important point the caller brings up, and it is exactly our concern that, and unfortunately, as you mentioned at the top of your show, the veto by the governor for the $14.9 million, which would have been important startup costs to make sure that some of these programs and services could be immediately put online, really hamper us right out of the gate, and it does make us concerned that maybe that commitment won't continue to be there. And so we do need to continue to work with our communities to make sure that this does not drop off the radar screen, because if there isn't consistency and there isn't the right amount of resources put into there, you could wind up with 58 mini disasters similar to what you have in CYA. And I think that everyone's trying to avoid that. But, you know, even at the 117, which sounds like a lot of money, I mean, they were talking about it maybe costing up to $280,000 to treat and confine a ward at CYA. But yet the state only chose to give us $117,000. And so there's definitely, again, that cautious optimism in trying to change the tires on a moving bus. We need to make sure that people know, well, the probation plans on implementing and doing the best job we can, because that's what we do for these kids and within our juvenile system. But these first couple of years are going to be rocky, because really the resources aren't there in the startup phase.
Kathleen, join us. You're on.
Yes, my name's Kathleen. I'm calling from Santa Rosa, and I have been of service to the state throughout an H&I 12-step programming, bringing meetings into juvenile halls and prison systems. And basically, just in a nutshell, and I'm writing a book actually on this, is the bottom line that I see is that we need to start at the grassroots level. We need to think globally and act locally. It starts from breaking the cycle of addiction and abuse before it becomes a judicial and a judicial burden. And this is the only answer. It's especially when referencing the former psychosocial responsibility position, you know, additionally addressing the inbreeding of the CYA, and then also the next step being the penitentiary system. Something needs to be done aside from just throwing money at these organizations and these unions in order to take an individual on an individual basis.
Now, this is an attempt pretty much to do something
and I'm excited
bring reform.
About hearing
yeah.
that. And I would like very much to speak with you off air, or, you know, make contact with you. I will look up SB 81, and the other thing I wanted to state was just that, you know, as a society, as much as we would like to turn our heads and put, you know, put our blinders on and say, you know, not in my neighborhood or not my kid, as a society, we are accountable for breaking the cycle of violence, drug addiction, illiteracy, and lack of conscience. And that comes from right action. That comes from, taking every day, choosing up to not allow the negative behavior from children, to not allow the violence or the tendency towards aggression that can come from a child, when in actuality they're just asking for support. So I'm in great support of what you're doing.
And we thank you, Kathleen, for your call. Daniel McAleer.
Yeah, I just in comment, I think it's important to point out that these types of reforms are very difficult. The problems in the youth authority have been known for decades. Reagan's director of the California, Governor Reagan's director of the California Youth Authority, Alan Breed, lamented in an article back in 1972 about the failures of the youth authority to provide rehabilitation services, and that it was just little more than a penitentiary. The reason these forms occurred right now is really the work of a very small number of extraordinary individuals. The people from the prison law office, Sarah Norman and her group, John Spector, who initiated this lawsuit. And then you had people like Sue Burrell from the Youth Law Center and David Steinhardt, who's an extraordinary advocate in the state legislature, pushing this, helping draft this legislation and pushing it through. The people from Books Not Bars. But ultimately, what Governor Schwarzenegger deserves some credit on this, and I believe and Karen Pank as well, who was there when this started. Governor Davis fought all attempts to make changes in the California Youth Authority and was ready to spend vast amounts of money to fight it legally. Governor Schwarzenegger, to his credit, came in, recognized, acknowledged that there was a problem, allowed the lawsuit to go ahead, entered into a consent decree. Once we entered into a consent decree, then the whole thing started to snowball and ultimately leading to SB 81. It's a story about what can be done with a few determined individuals who are willing to take on the challenge, and I think it should be talked about.
There were fiduciary reasons too, though. I mean, Karen Pank, this was an expensive proposition. California youth prison system was getting marks. Again, I don't know what the touchstone is to determine this, but a failure rate of somewhere near 75%. You're saving money by sending kids back to the counties, pure and simple, aren't you?
Absolutely, and it's always the case, especially in the criminal justice system. We believe that if you provide money to what we call the front end of the system, when there's first contact, which is usually involving probation, that's where you will get the biggest bang for your buck by trying to infuse the money there. And we work with community-based organizations daily, especially in the juvenile arena, but some in the adult arena as well. But it is an extraordinary reform that has been tried for years and years. So, I mean, that's, again, why, even though I know a lot of my comments have been directed towards the resources piece, towards our being concerned about how this will all pan out in the end, it really was the leadership of all of the people just mentioned, including, you know, the chiefs who, for the first time, decided, even though there was a lot to be, at risk by going forward with this, stayed at the table with Senator Machado and the governor and others to try to put together something that may work going forward a lot better than what we currently have now. And so it's really an exciting time, and it's just the beginning, is I think my point to everyone, is that we need to stay on top of this, because the implementation piece of it is going to be difficult, but it could, prove to really make California a leader in the juvenile system.
And here's a listener who writes, I'd like to comment on the hiring of staff of the juvenile system. I've been working as a line staff for about 6 years, and I chose this profession because I enjoy working with kids. The problem I see, though, is that new staff is hired as entry level with no previous work experience and little college education. Excuse me. I came in after 4 years of military service and 10 years of professional work experience, and it took me over a year to get used to the environment of juvenile hall. 20-year-old kids are placed in charge of 30-plus youth, some with mental illness, drug addiction, family problems, and violent behavior. This is a major problem, and this is, of course, just the sort of thing that is mm-hmm. hoped will be remedied by Senate Bill 81. Karen Pank, what about probation, though? I mean, that's in your bailiwick. Yeah. Are we going to see some major changes there, or changes again that will hasten a day when we don't see so much recidivism?
Well, that's certainly what we hope for, and I think that's what we'll all be working towards. I mean, the person who sent in the email, I point out one of the many hurdles that we're going to have to get over. There's certainly a recruiting and retention problem in many of our counties for probation officers, and I don't think SB 81 is going to remedy that situation per se, because there's probably a lot of other issues that aren't addressed by that. But we are, if we have a better place to work and a better environment, and most of the people that we attract to probation, we find, are people who do want to get involved with kids' lives and make a difference. It's one of the nice things about our probation departments, is that's really universally kind of the motivating factor for getting involved. So I think if we start seeing, a turn to trying to get the right services connected to the right kids with the supportive resources, and not felt like things were just being pushed down to the county because the state didn't want to deal with it anymore, I think you will see that kind of reform happen in a successful way. And so, it's going to be a wait and see, but we are actively trying to make sure that's what happens.
And we're going to bring more of our callers in. Ray, thanks for waiting. You're on forum. Good morning.
Hi. So when you have a child or that's, got drug problems or whatever, it occurs to me that sometimes this child is not ready to act like an adult, and you need to have interventions and put them into like either mandatory drug program or stuff, something like that. Aren't we running the risk, or haven't we run the risk in the past by using some of these county programs to do that, and maybe, abrogate some of these kids' rights and maybe run back into the lawsuit game of where people are objecting to the fact the way we're controlling or trying to enhance these people's lives by imposing our values on them?
Daniel McAllen.
What we need to do is institute a wider array of options that judges and probation staff can utilize. A lot of the programs that we have now and we've historically relied upon have been inadequate to the task. And I don't think anyone will argue that. The challenge ahead is to develop a range of programs from secure custody programs. When I say secure custody, where kids are confined, but they're not confined in a violence in a violence-filled environment where all they learn is a gang culture, where they actually get treatment. And then once they leave that facility, they get adequate follow-up services to help them with that transition and to extend beyond into their family and into their neighborhoods. Because changing kids' lives, it's a comprehensive task, and it can't be done in isolation. You've got to confront the entire constellation of factors in a kid's life, which is something corrections and probation services have historically not been able to do because the resources haven't been there. So the challenge is going to be not only do we have the resources, but also how we expend those resources. And I think the caller's point is well taken.
Deeper and more profound question is, how do you change the culture? I mean, particularly when you have a lot of gangbanging going on, and there are a lot of the magnet of gangs in particularly some of the urban areas.
Well, once again, that's going to be the challenge. What we do now is we simply reinforce that gang culture when we place them in a gang filled institution. So
training ground for even more criminality and eventual trajectory into the penitentiary.
The goal was to reduce propensity for violence or gang involvement, we were doing just the opposite.
Well, let's hope that day will come to a close, because there is a great deal of cautious optimism attached to Senate Bill 81. We spoke earlier with the sponsor of that bill, State Senator Michael Machado, again, who represents the 5th District. We also spoke with Perry Gabriel Jones, youth advocate for DDAT, Detention Diversion Advocacy Program, and chair of San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom's Youth Task Force Committee, a former California Youth Authority inmate. And I want to thank our two guests who've been with us the hour, Daniel McAleer here in studio with us, executive director and co-founder of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Thank you, Dan. And thanks, Karen Pank, Executive Director of the Chief Probation Officers of California. Karen Pank joined us from Sacramento.
Thank you.
Thanks to you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, of course, and we're going to be with you another hour. We're here with you generally 9 to 11, Monday through Friday, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. The second hour of this morning's program is also going to be dealing with youth, but from a different perspective. We're going to talk about what makes young people happy, particularly in that post-boomer stage between the ages of about 13 and 24, excuse me. Some new studies out, and even some contradictory studies that have to do with the pursuit of happiness by young people in that age demographic. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Danny Bringer. And, our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Lest we misunderstand that score. Again, thank you for being a part of this morning's forum program. Another hour coming your way after news. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.